Tonight's class is kind of a workshop. I mean, these readings fall at a nice spot, given that it's midterm week, and I'm not inclined to quiz you on this. And this is, you only had 10 pages to read here. Some of you might have not noticed that and gone on and read the animal rights stuff, which is interesting. You know, but our main focus is really just 10 pages today. So I want to set it up as a workshop for small group. I want to be real specific about what I'm going to ask you to do in small group, and I think it might be a good exercise. So it's going to require your concentration, though, on the first part. So let's do this together. And if you have the article handy, please bring it out. It helps when you guys, as I was bragging about you, you guys do this pretty well. When you guys bring other things in from the articles that that you've read, okay? And try not to fall into your screens if you're looking at your beautiful laptop screens. I'm sure there are more interesting places on the internet than... Well, no, this is the most interesting place to be, right? Yeah, come on, what am I saying? Okay, so what I'd like you to do in your notes is actually kind of keep in mind Chorus Guard. So we're going to kind of have a comparison running while we reconstruct Singer. And last time I told you there were a couple of things to keep an eye on. One was to what extent these critics identify with something called naturalism, right? Which you know from last class is the view that in morality, in ethics, would be the view that ethics can be understood solely in terms of our natural history, right? We don't need to appeal to anything outside of our natural history. And then gradualism, which was what we called Duvall's view that human morality is a gradually more complex evolution from primate morality, and it's based in emotions. Okay, so we had Chorus Guard's critique of that, which really had to do with an analysis of intentionality. Remember that, and the idea that the big gap that argues against gradualism, the non-gradual step, was the point at which humans developed a concept of intentionality that allowed them to choose not only means to ends, but ends themselves. Remember that from last class? So the question she posed was, we're the only animal that does morality because we're the only animal that asks, is my desire for this a good reason for doing it? Whereas non-human animals only choose among means to pre-programmed instinctual goals, right? Food, mating, et cetera, safety. So that was kind of Chorus Guard, right? And you got to see her analysis. Now, Singer is going to have a take on, and remember, Chorus Guard also thought, what did she, do you remember, anybody remember what she thought of veneer theory? Real quick, anybody? Yeah, she said it's not even worth paying attention to, it's incoherent. So let's start our comparison there, right? Remember the reason she said it just doesn't make sense to think of humans as isolated self-interest maximizers. That's not compelling. We've never been that. We're always social. Ethics is about a way of being, a way of relating to the world. But nice kind of move there. But notice how different it is going to be from, how different it is from what Singer says about veneer theory. Wow. And I'm giving you some notes here to help out, but, you know, what does Singer say about veneer theory? Get the article out, let's work with it. Does he think it's not worth taking seriously? Thanks, start us off.
Doesn't he say that it's part of our morality is a veneer layer?
He says it a little differently, but you're on the right track. He says the conflict between self-interest and morality runs through the history of ethics. Veneer theories, he takes it seriously. He thinks that Duvall was too harsh. Veneer theory really... Well, not veneer theory exactly. Notice how he says it. He doesn't say veneer theory runs through history, because that wouldn't make sense. I mean, veneer theory is the idea that we only recently acquired a veneer of morality over our deep self-interest. Singer puts it a little differently. So that was the image of a sphere. Remember that diagram? A sphere with the coating being the veneer. The metaphor for Singer would be that through the history of ethics, there's been a constant tension between self-interest and altruism, or morality. So he doesn't think of morality as, you don't have morality as long as you're just thinking in terms of self-interest. So there's always been a tension across time between these two forces in humans. And that's not so different from veneer theory. Like veneer theory, it says there's a tension between self-interest and altruism. Okay, we're getting into it a little bit. Now, Singer identifies very strongly with naturalism, and I think that's important. Remember, Korsgaard is a Kantian, and so she thinks, really, being moral, you'll know this from your understanding of Kant, I'll just remind you, she thinks being moral really does involve setting aside desires and inclinations. So even though she's a naturalist, she doesn't dispute evolution, she understands that our ability to have complex intentionality comes out of our natural history. Even though she's a naturalist, she's a Kantian, so she thinks all of our natural impulses are irrelevant to ethics. Remember that from our study of Kant? Kant's about reason and respect for persons, right? Okay. Singer is not a Kantian, so he's right, he's a utilitarian. His identification of naturalism is likewise pretty thorough, but he says he agrees more maybe with Duhalde. He says morality does come from nature. Morality does come from evolution, and he specifically identifies kin selection, which we haven't talked about yet. So let me give you a note on that. And he identifies in-group partiality as two things that are in the history of our evolved morality, but they don't really constitute morality. Okay, we'll get into this stepwise. Kin selection, which we haven't talked about, is the theory that social species. Let me put it succinctly. We're willing to be altruists for our kin in proportion to our genetic similarity to our kin. I'll say it again. We're altruists toward kin, toward people we're related to, in proportion to our genetic similarity. And biologists have been able to study this in pretty scientific ways in terms of measuring helping behaviors. So helping behaviors among siblings are the strongest because siblings have, especially twins, have high levels of genetic similarity. So kin selection is a theory in biology which says that altruistic behaviors track genetic similarity. That's the most succinct way to put it. Yeah, Laura.
Is this just strictly looking at kin that is kind of more biological, or does it doesn't as much include more of the developed kin? I don't know how to describe that, but a team of some sort.
Yeah, I think the dynamic there is in-group partiality. So our affiliations with. So one way to explain altruism is that it could be that we're being altruistic toward kin, but they're really like us, that they're genetically us. So kin selection really doesn't require genuine altruism. It's really just the self-interest that you have toward your genetic similars. So helping your brother or sister get their genes into the next generation is pretty much as good as helping you get your genes. Not quite as good, but pretty much as good as getting your genes into the next generation. But helping your cousin get their genes into the next generation, they're not quite as similar here. And so among other non-human species, you can actually observe helping behaviors proportional to genetic similarity. Does that make sense? So it seems like a very biologically based sort of self-interested morality. But it doesn't require going beyond self-interest. The biological altruism in kin selection is really Like, it's an altruism that says, hey, you're pretty much me, so I'll help you, right? Okay? And then the in-group selection, in-group partiality we've seen with Haidt and with DeWall. So the point is that Singer is identifying with naturalism. He says morality does come from evolution, but human morality doesn't happen until you get reason overriding emotion. So there's the argument, there's the point at which he's going to dispute gradualism. So he's a naturalist. He thinks that's where we get everything. He says even reason comes from evolution. There's no other place for it to come from. But reason makes a categorical difference. And he says, you know, even DeWall seems to acknowledge this. Okay, we've got the 6 o'clock bells here. We should all meditate on something here. Even DeWall seems to appreciate this. Remember this, there's this passage in DeWall. Yeah, Suyeon?
Sorry, could you repeat what you just said?
Sure.
Is that relating to the in-group partiality thing?
Okay, yeah, good. So Singer's going to say, yes, morality comes from evolution, but reason makes a big categorical difference. Yeah.
So is Singer saying that if you're acting in a way such that, like, kin selection and partiality, if you're acting in a way that supports that, are you not making a moral decision?
He doesn't think that's not human morality. That is you know, good question. Yeah, he's saying yeah, that looks like morality, and biologists will call this biological altruism. You know, that's a recognized term in people who study this. But yeah, he's saying, hey, it's not genuine. It's not human morality. So, yeah.
Is there a way to describe this outside of procreation?
Outside of procreation?
Mm-hmm.
Well. Yeah, this involves genetic similarity, which is going to come out of procreation, right? Is that what you're thinking, right?
Yeah, I just mean
this one isn't.
Yeah.
This is just your...
Maybe I need to think.
Yeah, sure. It is. Think about it. Tell me where you're going with it, because it is interesting to note that when humans, for most of our natural history as humans or as Homo sapiens, the small groups we lived in, we were actually kind of related to those people. I mean, there were ways that when humans raided other groups of humans, they did capture people, and that most biologists would say that's part of keeping a gene pool going. But yeah, in-group partiality is not completely different from kin selection, because you'd be related to lots of people in a small group. Is that correct?
Yeah, but so say with outside of this idea that, like, the goal would be to get your genes to the next generation, and
right.
Procreation is, because, I don't know, I have a tendency to find it difficult to
mm-hmm.
see that morality would be derived from something that is about gene
okay.
continuation.
Yeah.
Or procreation, that, like, morality
good.
Would be based off of a procreationist ethic.
Yeah, well, not based off, but you're falling in line maybe with Singer then, because Singer would agree with you. He said, this isn't real human morality. This is maybe where our morality came from in some sense. But the crucial step is when we use reason to override our partiality. And even DeWall kind of acknowledges this in a passage where he talks about needing to be disinterested to really make, to be an impartial spectator. So this is the key point for your notes. For Singer, the crucial difference that argues against gradualism is that he thinks real human morality comes about when reason allows us to overcome partiality. He says reason isn't tied to sociality. It's not tied to our feelings of group membership. It's not tied to kin selection. It's the faculty that allows us to defeat that. You feel the strength of the objection here? Yeah.
Can you repeat that phrase, like, real human morality comes about when reason overcomes?
Overcomes or defeats partiality.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that biological partiality?
Yeah.
That
yeah. That's what he's thinking about, these two forms of partiality, kin partiality and in-group groupishness. We can just say groupishness. Yeah, good, good question. See, that's what you guys, I wish my other class section did more of these questions. So tell them. You know, you probably know some of those people. Don't make them feel bad.
Give me some names.
What?
Give me names.
Give me names, yeah. You see the roster? You can look at the roster. Yeah. Email them. Say, hey, we're better. No. Okay. I don't want to stimulate your groupishness, you know. You know, soon we'll all be a team and we'll wear t-shirts and stuff. Okay, good. Okay, other thoughts? It just helps you understand stuff if you kind of ask questions about it and kind of mull it over. All right, so that's his basic argument. And notice it's kind of similar. Let's see if we can point out some similarities and differences with Korsgaard's argument. So both of them agree that reason is a non-gradual difference. That's a similarity, right? Where they disagree is really here, right? That for Korsgaard, allowing us to choose ends, right? Remember, the key thing about human intentionality is it allows us to choose ends, not just means. For Korsgaard, that ability takes us beyond maximizing interests and maximizing happiness. It allows us to have a kind of ideal of humanity that's not connected with promoting our desires. But notice Singer is a utilitarian. For him, reason is the key ingredient that allows us to see the identity of human interests. That's a big difference. I'll repeat it. For Korsgaard, as a Kantian, reason helps us choose ends that take us beyond human desires. So we can realize a conception of humans as rational creatures. It's a very beautiful ideal, right? Respect for persons is respect for you as a rational creature. It's not about making you happy, remember? We talked about all that. But for Singer, this is the difference, right? For Singer, reason is the non-gradual difference that allows us to see the identity of our interests. Remember that formulation in utilitarianism? Your happiness is as important to you as mine is to me, right? And that's the key insight that you don't get without reason, for Singer. You don't get that from our evolution. Our evolution is all about partiality. So you see where your group discussions have to engage this question about, or I'm going to ask you to engage this question about the role of partiality in morality. Well, I'll sharpen that for you. You don't need to think about that yet. There's one more step we need to get out here. Maybe some of you can help me with this. Singer expresses his argument by an objection to Dewall's use of the trolley problem. So you all remember the trolley problem. Yeah, please, before we go. Yeah.
Really, really quick.
You bet. Yeah,
what time period are they both based
in? Korsgaard and Singer?
Because I know that they're both discussing the same article, but are they vastly different?
It's a good question.
Like,
I think
growth.
They're both alive, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Korsgaard's, I think, a little younger, but probably 10 or 15 years younger than Singer. Singer's getting pretty old.
Okay.
They're both famous philosophers. Yeah.
So
they're all contemporaries. They know Dewall. They've met him at conferences. They probably have beers with him. You know, I mean, it's a society. It's a good question. It helps you imagine what's going on when you ask about that. Yeah. Okay, so last step, trolley problem, right? Remember the trolley problem, lever condition, bridge condition. Remember Josh Green's fMRI research? Can somebody remind us of that? That was pretty cool stuff. Somebody probably remembers that pretty well. Yeah, good.
When they looked at people's brain, when they did the trolley problem where they had to push the people, they had more emotional responses.
Right. So we have evidence of a more emotional disgust reaction maybe at the idea of having to push the guy. We have more of a calculative reaction, areas of the brain we associate with calculation, although those areas are not, as we know from the Damasio research and other people, those areas are not completely separate. But yeah, relative difference in brain activation, which seems to correspond to more calculative thinking in the lever condition and more emotional response in the bridge condition. So now what's Singer's criticism? So that's the trolley problem, that's the fMRI research on the trolley problem. What's Singer saying about, how does he dispute the DeWall's use of the trolley problem? See, well, let's remember what DeWall said, right? Anybody got that? DeWall implies, I'll do this for you. DeWall implies that the different reactions are legitimately different moral responses. That's the point. So DeWall thinks both the fMRI evidence shows that an emotional response is part of our moral machinery. See what I mean? He thinks it makes sense that you're disgusted. Why does it make sense morally? Because it's betrayal. Betrayal's a bad thing. Betrayal is, you know, when you betray your group, holy cow, we're going to send you out. Right? Does that make sense? Do I need to say it again?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a little hard. That's good. DeWall thinks that the different fMRI signatures, brain activation signatures, in the two conditions of the trolley problem, lever and bridge, are both legitimate moral reactions. Because it's legitimate to want to help the group by favoring, you know, saving more people, but it's also legitimate to have a disgust reaction to betraying someone in the group, and that's what you're doing when you push the guy over the bridge. You're betraying. That's not a good thing morally for humans. I mean, we didn't do well as a social species because we would just kind of lightly take one of our group members and say, okay, sorry, you know, why? Because think of the logic of that. If you're in a group where they'll do that, what's your next thought?
I should not stay in this group.
Yeah, I'm thinking it might be me next. Oh, this is a weird connection. See, you guys also get me to think of these strange connections. God, I haven't thought of this for so many years. Maybe you'll find this funny, I don't know. In graduate school, that's a long time ago. I was at this party, and it was really weird. Someone would leave the party, and the remaining people would start talking about them. And at some point, some of the people in the party and I were like, my God, I don't want to leave. Like, what are they going to start talking about? This is supposed to be leave. Anyway, sorry. But you see, it's a similar idea. It's like part of feeling comfortable with people as a group is thinking that they're not going to like talk stink behind your back or betray you, push you off a bridge. My goodness. Okay. So we're almost there. DeWall thinks that the fMRI signatures are legitimate moral differences. Singer is the last step we need. What does Singer think? Singer's saying, look, DeWall's misinterpreting the evidence on the trolley problem. Why? What does he think? What does he think that the different fMRI signatures of brain activity really show? Anybody do this?
I'm not sure if this is what you're getting at, but like, wasn't it that after people thought about it for a little while, they agreed?
That's relevant. That's very relevant.
And so they were able to like overcome their emotional response with like reason.
That's, you know, you're pulling out a really interesting thing from Haidt that's relevant. It's not quite the trolley problem, but remember the evidence in the last chapter of Haidt we read where you could get people to not just defend their positions if you gave them more time? Is that what you're thinking of?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good example. Singer would have agreed with citing that. Let me say it more directly. Let's say it in relation to the trolley problem. That's a really good thing to bring in. Singer thinks that the right answer is to always save more people. He just thinks that's the right answer. That's the utilitarian answer. So for him, if you experience disgust at the bridge condition, you got to get over that. You see what I mean? You got to get over that because the point of your notes is he thinks the right answer is to save more lives in every case. So if you feel disgust, maybe that's a vestige of your groupishness. That's keeping you from doing the right thing for Singer. So you got to get over that. Hey, this is not, it doesn't feel good to push the dude, but you know, this is what reason tells you, because reason tells you it's four people versus one. In both cases, remember, that's the kind of the So a utilitarian looks at the trolley problem very differently than a primatologist, right? For a primatologist, it's like, oh yeah, good. You know, we've got we've got emotions for solidarity, non-betrayal, and we've got intuitions, rational intuitions about benefiting the group. But those are in conflict, and that's a legitimate conflict for DeWall. For Singer, it's like, you know, get with it. Reason tells you what the right answer is. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what he was meaning by the like impersonal adding significance and the kind of activation of like emotions? Because within the trolley problem, he was talking about like emotions being activated. I was a little I found myself interested, but I wasn't
sure.
Entirely sure.
If I'm remembering what you're asking, maybe we need to look at the text. It was the idea that you don't. Yeah, it's actually just popped out here. He thinks the small number of people who would push the guy off the bridge are right. And what they're doing that's right is they're overriding their disgust.
So that's activating emotion?
It's overriding it. The activation's automatic. It's the realization that this is the right thing to do. Oh, I don't want to do it. Well, remember, he said, you know, that's been a tension in ethics all through our history. So the thing to do is to the right answer is to push the guy. Yeah. Sophie.
So then, are you saying that like Singer would even more so praise people who don't have that initial disgust and just say like?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, one of the things I want you to do in your group is group work is try to identify cases where you think being moral really requires you to have emotions and where you wouldn't do the right thing if you couldn't feel the emotions. And then cases, and we've done a little bit of this once a few weeks ago, but I want you to do it a little more thoroughly now that we're in this context. Cases where, you know, where Singer's right, where you do, doing the right thing really requires overriding emotion. Okay.
So he's saying there has to be that emotional component first?
Yeah, I didn't quite answer your question. Singer might praise someone who just kind of doesn't feel that. But notice what you could be experiencing here is the difference between people's personalities. Some of us are less empathetic than others. Some of us make decisions more based on rational calculation than others. DeWall is saying that range of personalities is all part of our moral, you know, resources. Singer's kind of saying, no, the stuff that comes out of evolution is really keeps us partial to our kin and our group, and that limits. You don't get human morality until you get impartiality. Okay? So here's the prompt for your groups. I've got three things I want you to do. I'd like you to evaluate Singer's response in general. Just see if you agree with it, if you think DeWall is still right. Then I'd like you to do this categorization thing, and I'll put it on the board. It's going to be cases in which being moral requires emotion and requires overcoming emotion, and other cases which involves overcoming emotion. So I'd like you to think of kinds of cases or specific cases and get a good list going. This is part of doing philosophy, is to give yourself something to look at here, some cases. And then I've got one more thing to ask you to do. Is that clear? When does being moral require you to have emotional intelligence, emotional sensitivity, and when does being moral require you to really set aside your emotions? And you'll come up with interesting cases. We'll all do this. It'll be great. The last thing I want you to do is, I introduced this concept of expanding the circle. Remember that from last class? Ethicists talk about, and actually Singer uses this phrase in this essay too. Expanding the circle refers to the tendency in human morality to expand the circle of moral concern from just our group to all humans, from just humans to animals, from just humans and animals to the environment. You feel it? Expanding the circle there seems to be a trend in our thinking, whether it's right or wrong, toward progressively seeing the moral community as bigger and bigger, including more and more. So if you're an environmentalist on ethical grounds, you probably think that the environment is part of our moral concern, right? That's one way to be an environmentalist. So my question for you is, how do we expand the circle just through reason, or do we expand the circle also through emotions? Are we expanding the circle because we're expanding our capacity to feel suffering of others who don't look like us, who don't live near us, who we're not related to? Or do you expand the circle by using reason to overcome your impartiality toward people who don't look like you, don't live near you, and aren't related to you? Singer obviously thinks it's the latter. So Singer thinks you expand the circle by getting rational. My question is that true? Do you expand the circle only by getting rational, or do you expand the circle by expanding your capacity to feel suffering? And I'll just give you this anecdote. You know this already, probably. In the late 19th century, and especially in the late 19th century, anthropology started getting going in Western Europe. So we started sending people out to really kind of study and interact with non-Western European people. Well, you know the history of this. The history is not good. I mean, prior to anthropology, and even during the early part of anthropology, growth of anthropology, Western Europeans basically thought of themselves as humans and other people as kind of savages, to the point where they would bring back specimens, you know, put them in cages and put them on display. I mean, you still had slavery. You get slavery partly because you don't perceive the enslaved creatures as humans. So you don't owe them, there's no moral concern. Notice the circle is small. You don't perceive them as part of your moral community. Same thing with animals. Think of the way we're concerned about how people treat animals now. You know, a couple generations ago, you would have talked to somebody about the treatment of animals, what? Who cares if they suffer? They're not us. So my point is that when people talk about how humans have expanded the circle of moral concern, it's pretty dramatic when you think about the real history here. So have we done that because Singer's right, and we've actually just reasoned our way to seeing that their happiness is just as important to them as mine is to me? Or have we done that? Have we expanded the circle partly because we've expanded our capacity to feel things? Okay, so three things for your groups. Start with a quick check-in on what you think about Singer's response to DeWall. And then second thing, try to come up with types of ethical problems where being emotional helps, is maybe necessary, and other kinds where you need to overcome it to be moral. And then finally, how do we expand the circle? How is this happening? Is it happening only through reason, or is it also happening through emotion? Can you think of examples that support one answer or the other? Okay, a lot of work to do. Please take your time with it. Engage each other. Feel free to commiserate about exam weeks and so on. Okay, this could be a good 10 minutes, so get with each other and keep working. Yeah.
I
enjoy them. And I think the idea of like separation from group and kind of thinking for self being like the head of center of morals. It's a interesting sentence, especially when you talk about like.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like you're trying to like, you're
Okay, a minute or so, and then we'll compare notes.
I was like, I'm going to open that.
Okay, guys, let's do this together. Okay, so I'd like to kind of start maybe with the second one. That's fine, no rush. We're good. And let's start with the second task, which was to think of cases in which being moral requires experiencing emotions, or cases in which being moral requires setting aside emotions. So we might have some overlap between your groups and what I came up with, but let's kind of figure, I'd like to hear your cases. Yes, please.
One example we thought about something that requires emotion is taking care of, like premature babies or like really, really old people who are like potentially sick,
right.
And how like it like emotionally like we're tied to those people because we have a relationship with them or whatever.
Good.
But like from a rational standpoint, it may be a better use of resources to like let them die or like kill someone with Alzheimer's or something like that, and like give those resources to like someone in poverty or something.
Yeah. So you could add to my list. You could add caregiving. A caregiver who couldn't experience the emotions of the patient wouldn't be a good caregiver, would be an unvirtuous caregiver. So you could go a couple different ways. You could say, well, it's just a bad caregiver, it's not an immoral one. But you could imagine, you know, that not being able to do this would just not, you wouldn't show respect for the person if you couldn't feel their suffering. Good. Yeah, I would include big categories of relationships, like being a good partner, being a good team member, being a good friend. Can you really do these things virtuously without monitoring your emotions and monitoring what other people thought about your responsiveness to them? You know, did these kinds of examples also come up for you? Or other examples? Okay. Other cases on either side here? I mean, cases where you set aside emotion, there's some obvious ones. I bet a lot of you had the same things on your list as me. Any matches here? Cases where you're trying to be fair? Basically, we were trying to give equal opportunities, competitions. What came up? Yeah, what were your cases for cases where you had where being moral requires you to set aside your emotions?
I think like one of our group members talked about
Is
the law system and how there's a lot about being in that court system that you cannot use your emotions and you can't choose who you think is best.
Yeah, I mean the image of justice blind, you know, holding the scales, it's really a fundamental part of our conception of law and justice that you don't get treated differently because of how people feel about you. I mean, come on, what would a justice system be like if we treated people differently who we didn't care about, who weren't in our in-group? And we do have issues of injustice where people get treated differently because they look different or they come from a different walk of life, or they get better, treated better because they're rich. Yeah.
I would argue that in that situation, that is using a form of emotional intelligence to say, to recognize the like humanness and the emotional level, or it is just using a different kind of emotional setting within yourself. I wouldn't say it's completely setting aside emotions. Personally.
Yeah, you should work out a theory like that. I don't see it immediately, but I could imagine somebody trying. It might be, let's work on it. Because people do talk about a passion toward justice. So you could be thinking, like, well, there are emotions animating this. It's not all calculation. It's not all in personality. Being just. My example was going to be to say, this is a small digression, you don't need to take any notes. ADR refers to alternative dispute resolution, and in some, even within a formal justice system, you often have ADR, like mediation, in traditional justice systems, like Native American systems and traditional cultures, often justice is thought of as satisfying the parties at an emotional level, too, right? So sometimes people choose ADR as an alternative to going to court because they feel like they're going to get a richer kind of satisfaction, which includes getting your emotions addressed, getting your feelings addressed.
Emotions can kind of raise red flags within situations, and I think being aware of your emotions and not taking them as like fully fact is different from completely setting them aside.
Good point. No, I think this setting aside metaphor, ultimately we might decide there's something incoherent about that. Like, can we really do that? It's kind of an open question. You might want to put pressure on that and say, man, maybe we can't. Sometimes we are aware of emotions that would bias us, and we want to somehow put them out of action. So, you know, with implicit bias in hiring, that would be an equal opportunity issue. But also with our elaborate pseudonym method, it's to kind of help me bracket any positive, negative, or neutral associations I might have with who the person writing the paper is. And so sometimes that's a even if it's not setting, it's bracketing emotions or bracketing bias. Good. Yeah, I think this is moving. The possibility of having pretty rich lists like this moves me toward a skepticism about choosing between them. And so one of the things I want to suggest to you is that Singer is a criticism I'll make of Singer, and we didn't quite do this section, but this is a good time for you guys to come in with criticisms as well. A criticism I would make of Singer for your notes, even though I like him a lot, he's a famous philosopher, he's one of the most important philosophers in ethics of our generation, is that Singer is, this is the point for your notes, Singer's kind of old school on the relationship of reason and emotion. He thinks of it as an either or. And, you know, so you can think of it that way a bit, and you called this into question a bit, Laura, but, you know, he's kind of old school in the sense that he's not. So with Jonathan Haidt would be up to date on research which suggests, like, Damasio research, remember that, where the patients had lesions that prevented them from experiencing emotion. They couldn't plan their lives. That suggests emotion and reason are connected. Haidt's definitely telling us that emotion and reason are connected. In fact, emotion and automatic processes might be much more important than we'd realize. So let's just take a minute or two to think about, what would it be like, draw this in your notes, what would it be like for reason and emotion to be in a dynamic relationship? How could you support the claim that sometimes reason helps us feel emotions differently? Does experiencing emotion in a sophisticated way sometimes lead you to a better principle for how to behave? Let's get beyond this either or. Yeah, did you have something on this?
Yeah, because depending on my biological standard, if something elicits like a fear or an anger or a discussed from us, so we would probably avoid it. That would become ingrained as a natural reason, that's why we would not do or participate in something.
Good, good. But I wanted to, yeah, so right, so disgust can lead you to a principle, don't do that, you know. I want to take it a little further and suggest that suppose you experience disgust, you know, at someone for their sexual orientation. And I'll let you use a simpler example, sorry. Let's say you have a compulsive behavior, right? You have a compulsive behavior. Maybe you're a compulsive liar. Maybe you're compulsive about telling the truth. Those could both be problems. You might have this emotional response, and then you might say, "Wow, this isn't right. I'm kind of over the top on this." So you might use a rational reflection. This is what cognitive behavior therapy does, right? If any of you are into psych or know about this kind of therapy. Cognitive behavior therapy is about getting you to reason about your emotional reactions that are unhealthy. You know, maybe you're washing your hands 20 times before you leave the house. Maybe you're, you know, right? So emotions can, right.
I was going to say, like, emotions can help you reason further. So if you're really passionate about something, you're going to think more about it. You're going to dive into it.
Emotions are part of motivation. So they can motivate you to come up with arguments, right? That's one of the things that's happening in your papers, that you guys wanted you to start with your intuitions and see if you can argue for them. Yeah.
Would it be like if you're putting yourself in someone else's shoes, like maybe you disagree with how they're like responding to something, but you're like, oh, but I've never been in that situation, so I'm
absolutely
just trying to think of how they would feel.
Yeah, and can't that lead you to a more rational assessment of the situation? I mean, emotions could help you get to rational principles. Very good. What about the other way? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, actually, I think reason actually has more of an effect on emotion. It seems to have like a dampening effect on the extremes of emotion.
Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe one piece of evidence is that
good.
Children who maybe can't reason as well seem to, you know, have more extreme emotions, like more extreme sadness, more extreme happiness, whereas adults, you know, as life goes on.
That's a big developmental difference. I think your point could also be made. Do you have more on that?
No, I was just going to qualify that with maybe it's not a causation, but more just other causations for that.
Yeah, I was going to take it a little further beyond the developmental point and say, you know, sometimes reasoning helps you attenuate and experience emotions in a more sophisticated way. So can anybody think of a concrete example? Or are you going somewhere else? Okay, hang on. Can anybody think of an example where reasoning, you can reason about something and then open yourself up to, I think in the development of taste, for example, I mean, this isn't a moral example, but you know, you learn more about a favorite kind of food and you can kind of develop stronger emotions about it. Or you might learn more about, you might read factual articles about how people live in different parts of the world, and that may lead you to have a more empathetic response to them. Yeah. Laura, do you want to take this somewhere?
Yeah, I think that the relationship between the two, like there's a term for it, and it's emotional intelligence.
Good.
I don't know. Because the factors that play into that are motivation and empathy and social skills
and
self-awareness, and I'm blanking on the fifth one, but I can pull it up.
Good.
But,
no, that's right. And that kind of is a way of expanding the Damasio research item by saying, look, yeah, here's why.
Self-regulation.
Good. Yeah, here's why you can't reason well unless you can control your emotions. And the kids' example, now I'm seeing your point more in terms of kids versus adults. You can't, right?
Right, but the more I think about it, actually, I mean, there could be several other causes for that. It's not necessarily reason causing a dampening emotion, but just...
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But it's something to think about, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. The point for your notes would be that maybe Singer's out of touch in thinking that reason and emotion aren't in a dynamic relationship. It seems like we're going to get a lot. We've gotten some information from Haidt. We're going to get more from others about how these things affect each other. The rider and the elephant do affect each other, and so maybe we can cultivate emotional responses because we think harder about it. A lot of people got over their disgust of people with non-standard sexual orientations because they thought about it harder. You know, they thought about, you know, but they also got vivid examples. People came out and said, and, you know, to their parents, to their friends, and so they were like, wow, so you're just like, oh, so this is really kind of just like heterosexuals loving each other. Oh, okay. And that happened in the last 20 years in a big way in this culture. You know, so like I said, Republicans and Democrats don't really differ on anymore on the importance of that. And part of it was an emotional response to people in their lives. And then there was a reasoning side to that, too, where you kind of thought it through. And you said, wow, this isn't a moral abomination. This is someone who just has a different orientation. Likewise, I want to just end our class maybe on this idea that, you know, I asked you to think about whether we expand the circle only by reason, which would be what Singer would say, or whether we expand the circle of moral concern also by emotion. And this morning I was thinking about how to kind of get at this myself, you know, and I was thinking, okay, here's a weird alternate version of the trolley problem. Okay, ready? Imagine that saving the four workers required you to kill a kid in Indonesia. I mean, that's pretty hard to kind of set up a realistic way that would be true. But just imagine that that was, you know, with drones and stuff, who knows?
Well,
so,
you have to kill a tourist on the other side of the street.
Yeah, that's a lot like the guy on the bridge. But yeah, I want to make it more remote. And my point... Right. Well, actually, remember, we did have one alternate version of the trolley problem with the sharpshooter. I mean, one reason the trolley problem might be difficult is because it's four versus one. When I asked you guys if any of you would have trouble killing a person who was about to explode a dirty bomb in a city of 2 million people, I thought we got a pretty good consensus on that one. Like, yeah, I might have trouble doing it, but hey, there's no question. So part of the trolley problem might be that it's four versus one. Wow, that's kind of hard with a small community. But, you know, a million versus one? Give me the gun, you know?
Well, and it's like the intention, too. You'd have a harder time killing the guy who's just standing next to the truck, but the guy who's going to bomb,
That's right. There's a moral, this person is a moral devil. Right. A good point. That's a good point. My alternate version here involved a nice, innocent kid in Indonesia because, and my hypothesis was you'd feel disgust. Now, maybe you wouldn't have felt it 200 years ago, right? Because remember I was saying in the bad old days before we got more sophisticated about human difference, you know, we just would have said, well, that's not a human. What's the problem? It'd be like killing a dog because you got angry, you know, which we also probably would have not criticized as much a long time ago. So my point is that there are, in this case, the circle has expanded, I think, in part because we would feel disgust. And I think one reason we are caring more about absolute poverty is because we've had 50 years of media images which we react to emotionally, even though we're seeing people who are not like us. So a lot's happened in moral history in the last 200 years. The circle has really expanded. My point is, I think it's expanded because we've been thinking and we've been feeling. I don't think it's just expanded. Singer wants to say the moral circle expands when you rationally come to a conclusion about the equality of interest. Fair enough, but not everybody operates on such a uniquely calculative level. For some of us, it's a dialectical relationship between seeing pictures of people starving, maybe traveling and experiencing that, and then thinking about it, and then forming new intuitions. Maybe you start to heighten your sense of disgust. So now we get disgusted when we see people wantonly polluting things. You know, people just didn't have that kind of reaction 200 years ago. It's like, oh, there's a lot of nature out there. Don't worry about it. You know, we can't harm it. Okay, let's stop there, guys. Thanks for your energy and attention. This is really good. I really appreciate it. Tell that earlier section to get with it. What's that?